The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. And what a wonderful weekend for narrative fans. Jose refuses to criticise his players because we'll criticise him for criticising them even if they deserve criticism. Manchester City just managed to cope without De Bruyne. And Arsenal manager substitutes Mesut Ozil. Kane scores in August. And can Watford and Bournemouth get in the Champions League? Elsewhere, Real win without Ronaldo. Juve win with him. We'll round up Europe and the Football League, where boilers all over the Midlands were dancing in the streets as West Brom hit seven. All that and more on today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a panel today. Andy Brassel, nice to see you.
Likewise. Congratulations, Max.
Oh, that, we don't need to mention my wedding. I got enough stick for mentioning my A-level results on Thursday. This is going to be a disastrous start. But thank you. Paolo Bandini, how are you?
I'm very good. Congratulations, Max.
That's very kind of you to say so. Hi, Barry.
Hello.
Did you enjoy the wedding?
I loved it, yes. Very nice cake, great hospitality, lovely booze. Me and Merce had a great old time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you didn't invite me.
Lewis says, what was Barry's best man speech like?
Who was your best man?
Nick and John, but they didn't come either.
Okay.
Just family. Rob says, did Barry sing My Humps at the wedding? Martin says, what will Max now call the former future Mrs. Rushton? Calling her the current Mrs. Rushton makes it sound like she's been appointed until the end of the season. Like Big Sam. That'll do for now, won't it? And Stephen says, can we keep the wedding chat to a minimum, please? Okay. So then, aside from me getting married this weekend, Manchester United humbled by Brighton. This is from the Tweeting Seagull. He says, as a Brighton fan, growing up in the 90s, I watched our much-documented struggles coincide with the trophy-laden years of the Ferguson United era. Yesterday, Brighton beat United for the second time in a calendar year, so can you spend the whole pod talking about how great we were? I mean, probably not, Andy, is the answer. And actually, I think it's gone full circle now. You know where we say we have to start by giving credit to the smaller team? Actually, we don't need to do that anymore because everyone used to do that. Now we can just pile in on Manchester United's sort of bizarrely poor performance. Or not bizarrely poor performance.
Yeah, there's not a good vibe around there. I think that's pretty fair to say. I think the thing is, if you're a coach and you want to underline the fact that you're short of a few things in your team, thus that will need to be corrected by incoming transfers, you do that before the transfer deadlines come up rather than after. But you know, if that had been the plan, if this had been like 2 weeks ago, I think Lindelof and Bailey in particular would have done an absolutely fantastic job for Jose Mourinho while he was petitioning for an extra centre back. I do have a small degree of sympathy for Jose Mourinho because, you know, you're looking at players who, you know, there's no lack of quality in the team, but there was not much intensity there.
But if there are good players, then how can you have sympathy for Jose? Surely that he should be making them be better.
That's true. But, you know, it doesn't directly affect me. They're not my team.
Barry?
Well, Jose got stick last season for regularly fielding a defence that was entirely purchased by Sir Alex Ferguson. Yesterday, the two centre-backs, who were the worst of a very bad bunch, were awful. And they're his players. Now, Woodward, the chief exec, deserves some criticism for not acceding to Jose's demands to buy a new centre half, apparently on the grounds that the ones Jose wanted wouldn't be an improvement on Bay and Lindelof. But anyone would have been an improvement on them on the strength of yesterday's performance, and it's not hard to understand why they're so poor, because their confidence must be shattered when they've spent recent weeks listening to their managers say that they're not good enough. And surely, you know, it's on Jose. He bought both of them, he paid a lot of money for both of them, and they've both regressed since coming to United. He seems to be, and it's been said before, totally incapable of improving the players he has. They regress under him, and a good coach should be making them better.
I suppose there was a bunch of things going on in this game, wasn't there? It was sort of very obvious that Brighton set out from the beginning to press high, and they did so very effectively. They had a lot of men around the ball every time United had it, and of course what you thought in some of those moments, certainly with the contrast and the same data to how City play, is if these players were individually playing at the same level that City's players are playing at, this wouldn't be a problem. City are playing themselves out of almost identical situations at all the time. And if you commit men like Brighton were, I mean, like again, like four or five players around the ball at times, you actually leave yourself incredibly vulnerable to a simple pass to just take all of those players out of the running in one go. And yes, guys like Paul Pogba, who actually was critical of himself afterwards, weren't at key times able to do that. They weren't able to release the pressure on themselves by just playing smart, quick football. But to bring it back to Mourinho, there were times when just there seemed to be like a real lack of planning. And there was one particular point that got picked up by Paul Ince on Match Day 2. And sort of it was interesting. He highlighted one thing, and what struck me was a different thing. So it was on the action that led up to the penalty that United conceded. And he was pointing out that Lindelof was way out on the left-hand side playing very wide. So once United then gave the ball away off the goal kick, he didn't have time to recover and get back into the middle, and that's why he had this space to run into, which leads to the penalty. And that in itself didn't bother me so much. I think you see that all the time now. I think lots of teams, when they have possession, especially when they're looking to play out from the back, they do this. They shift from a back four to a back three. They have these formations that evolve and add extra people in different parts of the pitch, you know, reflecting where you are and where the ball is. But what bothered me is that you do that, you go to this back three and you create those spaces, and then the ball out from the goalkeeper is just a hoof into the middle of the field, where it seemed like, I think it was Pogba that was targeted with the ball, was all on his own in about 15 yards of space, and he's instantly swamped with the ball that's coming at him at chest height at a reasonable speed by about three other players. And you think, well, you can't just then play the ball into a space where you have no numerical advantage in a way that's awkward to control. And that was the problem. Like, you left situations like that that are, I'm not just about a player's individual quality. So I've said, you know, I think the players individual aren't doing something, but a situation like that is absolutely something you'd have thought would be discussed, that is planned for, how you're going to deploy the ball out from goal kicks. That's sort of basic football planning, and it just didn't seem to be there for the United in this game. So yeah, I thought they were sort of so many things to be bothered by in United's performance in this game, clearly.
And they were so meek as well. I mean, they were criticised a lot last season for their extreme defensiveness, and again, you know, away at Brighton, they should be asserting their authority, but they didn't have any authority. It was almost like they were afraid and played into Brighton's hands. And
do you think Brighton would do the same? Brighton definitely wouldn't do the same against City, but would they do the same against Spurs or Liverpool or Arsenal or Chelsea? I mean, they might try it, but I just don't think they'd set
Chris
up in
Hinton
such a way.
Chris has often been criticised for his conservatism and negativity, normally away from home. So obviously they were at home yesterday, but they were playing a team that most sort of middle to lower end Premier League teams would be afraid of, and they showed no sign of fear. And you know, even with his substitutions, Chris Hughton was forced to take Lewis Dunk off after 20 minutes, but apart from that, I don't think he made a substitution till the very last minute. When he made two, he took off Glenn Murray. You know, Glenn Murray terrorised the United defence. Glenn Murray, you know, he's a good player, but he shouldn't be wreaking havoc in the United defence on his own up front, and replaced him with a striker. You know, there was no suggestion that Hughton was in any way afraid or worried that United would get back into the game or get a point or go on to beat them, because, you know, he didn't bring on any extra defenders or anything. He clearly didn't see the need to do that.
It was a lovely finish from Glenn Murray, wasn't it? I mean, that is a great little flick. Andy, how's this going to play out?
I think a lot of it depends on how Manchester United do in the Champions League. Obviously, there's the possibility that they could get an incredibly easy group and sail through it, as has happened one or two times in the past. But yeah, of course, the Premier League's hugely important as well. And you know, I think I was not the only person to say at the start of the season that they just can't afford any slips in this opening part at all. And the reason it feels like a mini crisis is because it kind of is. And it's not just the way they played; it is the result as well. Because you look at the way Manchester City started last season. What everyone needs to do, the teams who have ambitions of at least holding on to their coattails past Christmas. So like Manchester United, like Liverpool, just don't drop too many points, because you know the league was pretty much over by November, December last year, and you know, as a neutral, that's something you want to avoid. But you know, I think we're looking at a possibility now where United could be out of the title race by November again, and you know that can't happen, surely.
Their next game is Spurs at home, and their approach in that will be very interesting. Hmm. You know,
what do you reckon they're going to grind out a 1-0? Do you reckon they're going to grind out a 1-0? Well, I mean, they did that against Spurs at Old Trafford last season, didn't they?
Yeah, it was a pretty boring game, and that was a late goal, wasn't it? Spurs had one good chance, and United had one good chance from a long ball, I think.
I mean, really, that would be ideal. You know, it's like, you know, Ricky Ponting for Australia in 2005. You know, not really having to captain, just having to bat all day at Old Trafford. That's Jose's ideal scenario, really, isn't it? Having to grind out a 1-0 at home.
One thing struck me today, actually, Eden Hazard, after Chelsea's win, you know, spoke about how great it was that Sarri wants them to have the ball and lets them play and create. And that's the exact opposite of what Jose wants. You know, he has said in the past, let the other team have the ball, because then, you know, they're going to make mistakes when they have the ball. And that's just not the Manchester United way at all.
Jordan says, if Jose gets sacked at United, which club would consider hiring him? I mean, he would get a job, but it's an interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, I don't think he needs to struggle for work. I think that in terms of places where you're talking about a really big club, although they haven't performed to that level recently, where he's still adored, he's still adored at Inter, and they would take him back if it wasn't for the fact they have Luciano Spalletti, who they still feel pretty good about, although they lost at the weekend. Then I could see that as a sort of real, I guess, high-profile landing place, which would seem viable, but... Yeah, his star has waned a bit. I don't think he would be short of Champions League clubs that would still be interested in him, but his star has waned a bit.
I don't think there's a lot of obvious landing spots. I mean,
well, we are at the very beginning of the season. So
but like even if we imagine we're halfway in the season and a couple of those managers fall short, say if the position was open at Bayern, I don't think they'd have him.
No.
I don't think Paris Saint-Germain would have him. That is their chance when he got fired by Chelsea. And a few years before that, they would have loved to have him. But, you know, they decide, I think Paris made a decision like, do we really want all that? Do we really want all the nonsense? Do we really want that football when we're trying to make our team, our club, a global brand? No. And, you know, I think even you look at the Portugal job, which would be something for him at some point. It's not something for him now, because Fernando Santos has got credit, he's got reasonably long contract, and like you say, with Inter, Spalletti just having signed a new deal, there's not a lot of... I think he's got like sabbatical half year written all over it if he does get fired before Christmas.
Do you think he'd ever take the Wolves job?
Oh, that'd be interesting, wouldn't it?
That's a great question.
I think he would, if it was, you know, I'd can't see what's his face,
Nuno
getting the bullet anytime soon, but I could see that working. I could see a fit there.
The only thing that would have made yesterday worse for Manchester United fans would be if Manchester City, without arguably their best player, had strolled to an easy victory against anyone in the Premier League, and it is exactly what they did, isn't it, Paolo?
They did. Although I know you're trying to move on here. I feel like for the sake of tweeting Seagull, we probably should say at least some some nice stuff.
I've tried.
No, fire away, Paolo.
I mean, I just think it's worth saying. I mean, first of all, that the reverse of me saying that United weren't good at playing their way out of those situations where they were the high presses. Yeah, absolutely the right call by Houghton to get on top of players whose confidence evidently isn't where it should be. And you've got a team which is you can see is feeling its way a little bit at the moment, then don't let them get comfortable. Get on top of them. And I think they've been good at doing that under Houghton at home particularly. I think it was, 29 points at home last season. So they do this well. I thought especially after the first goal, they stayed on it. They got at it. They sort of kept pressing the initiative and tried to get that second goal, which they did, obviously. And I think it's worth saying as well, something like 40 million quid's worth of new signings that he hasn't even got in that team yet. So, yeah, I think there's, you know, pretty impressive stuff.
Yeah, and there must have been the temptation to change it all around after last week. They were really poor at Watford. And actually, the only point in that game where they picked up, where the game was pretty much gone anyway, where they brought on Yves Bissouma, who I thought was great, and I would have expected him to start this week. And you're right, he went with the Old Faithfuls. But as Barry said as well, you know, they lost their best defender after what, 20, 25 minutes as well? Mm-hmm. So it's really impressive.
And it was a great finish by Murray.
I mean, yeah,
it
was delightful.
Yeah.
Another delightful finish. Well, a hat-trick for Sergio Aguero, Barry. And I mean, the first goal was beautifully taken. Edison's distribution is great, but there's something... I mean, when you're playing Man City, I know it's difficult, but to leave Aguero in that much space one-on-one just from a goal kick...
Well, I think Huddersfield didn't know whether to stick or twist. You know, they pressed high up the pitch and then probably weren't expecting Edison to play that pass to Aguero, and he duly did. Inch perfect, and Aguero, the finish was wonderful. And you know, he's a fantastic player. He's I think it was his 9th Premier League hat trick, probably his 13th in all for City. And it beggars belief to think that for a while last season he was considered to be surplus to requirements. I mean, how could you not want a man of his talents in your squad? He's a wonderful player.
Equal with Robbie Fowler.
And he also missed quite a few chances yesterday, you know?
I think Pep was asked, could he be more clinical? Pep said, oh, look, it's all right. If he gets a hat-trick, that's fine. he's equal on hat-tricks with Robbie Fowler, only bettered by Alan Shearer. Mendy as well. I mean, he is a tremendous player, Andy, isn't he?
He really is. And, you know, we've seen so little of that, of course, since he arrived at Manchester City because of that injury. He's almost more famous for flying up the touchline on his crutches to join in goal celebrations than he is for the actual football. But, you know, they made him the most expensive fullback in the world for a reason. And, you know, it's a shame to see him curtailed last season. He'd had such a tremendous season with Monaco. And, you know, he is a player who is an extra attacker, especially in games like that. His delivery is absolutely fantastic. The timing of his runs is terrific. I still think it's entirely coincidental that this performance came after Guardiola had that little word about him last week. And you know, there's got to be context that it was Huddersfield. But yeah, it's great to see. And you know, when they made their big impact in the market last summer and they got in Edison and the fullbacks, you thought, well, this is going to change Manchester City. Of course, he didn't have the chance to for a lot of last season, but you know, it's that old Arsene Wenger cliche, isn't it, about being like a new signing. As he's played less than 10 first team starts for Manchester City, I think he does still count as a new signing.
You watch Man City, Paolo, and everyone before the season said, well, it's not going to be quite as straightforward as last year. But I mean, they could win all 38 games, couldn't they?
I would like to state for the record that I said it would be as straightforward, if not more straightforward.
Duly noted.
Yeah, was I on a pre-season one with you as well, Baz? I feel like I've been pretty confident this City team's going to win the league. But look, Mendy. What was fascinating about him is that he's a player who genuinely adds a different dimension. I mean, it's not as if City didn't have enough different ways they could attack you, but actually, in like 11 games for them, he's already had two of the sort of individual games with the most crosses of any player in under Pep Guardiola, right? So he does something that you do not do at the moment. He gets out wide and he puts the ball in. And that's just yet another way in which City can now hurt you. And that's just sort of terrifying for everybody who doesn't have this sort of quality in... you know, even in their first set of options, if he's now, I don't know if he'll probably end up starting more often than not now, but just to have that as another option you didn't have last season on the way to winning 100 points is something.
Max, stop playing with the wedding ring. Twisting it away there.
Are you jealous?
No.
Lovely free kick from David Silva. Huddersfield, Barry, very difficult start to the season. I mean, you can ask for those two fixtures, but still.
If you're asking me, are they doomed because they got spanked by City? I'm not going to say yes. They obviously have problems, but a lot more teams are going to get spanked by Manchester City this season. They can't all go down. People are worried about Huddersfield. My main concern for them would be that I don't think David Wagner will stay there for the entire season. I think someone else will take him.
Well, you know, I think it's worth noting that both Arsenal and Huddersfield have played Man City and Chelsea so far, and Huddersfield lost by more goals, so they're probably in more trouble.
Well, Jonathan writes on the subject of Arsenal, how will Arsenal spend their parachute payments next season? 3-2 to Chelsea. It was a fun game, wasn't it, Addy? I think I've seen enough from Arsenal to think that they'll be fine. I don't think they've been as bad in either game as lots of people have said.
Yeah, same. I mean, the first one is Manchester City. With a little bit of luck here and there, they would and could have got closer. And they could have easily won the game on Saturday. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, it's such an unusual feeling to enjoy a game between Chelsea and Arsenal that much as a neutral. And, you know, just to think, neither of these are going to get in the top four. That was the take home I had from it, really.
Really?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that means you're putting Manchester United in the top four.
Yeah, I think they'll find a way.
That's interesting. Barry, do you go with that? Or do you see enough from Chelsea or Arsenal to suggest?
Well, as Andy said, Arsenal, with a bit of luck, could have won that game, or better finishing. They could have been, despite going two goals down, they could have been three clear at half time. But there seems to be an inherent Arsenalness about the fact that they didn't get the luck and they didn't win the game, you know. And despite mounting a heroic comeback after going 2-0 down, which possibly wouldn't have happened under Wenger, although that's, we can only speculate, they still went on to lose. And I thought their approach was weird, because they were absolutely bossing Chelsea for the latter stages of the first half, and then came out and it was as if they'd been told at halftime, right, look, just shut up shop, we'll take a point and just don't concede again.
Well, I don't know, it's not a bad thing, is it, Barry, if, like, you know, Emery had said, defend better than you did in the first half.
Oh, well, yeah, but they couldn't have defended much worse. But I worry about that defence. It's very slow, very, very slow. And
they still need Mertesacker.
So it will, yeah, that, you know, you can improve a defence, but you can't make slow defenders faster.
But you made this point on the wireless yesterday, that you weren't calling for Pulis or Allardyce to get the Arsenal job, but they would have done more with the defence than Emery has.
Well, that's the thing. That guys like them, they come into a club and they seem, whatever it is they do, they can sort out the defence very quickly. We saw particularly how they both did it at Crystal Palace. And, you know, Allardyce has done it pretty much everywhere he's gone. But Unai Emery and other coaches who are more highly regarded than Pulis and Allardyce don't seem to be able to do it, and I'm not sure how. I don't know how you go about doing it. I'm not sure how difficult it is, but those two guys, you know, Sam Allardyce is hawking himself around every media outlet going at the moment, saying, look at me, I need a job. Would he consider a couple of months as Arsenal's defensive coach beneath him? I don't know, but it might be worth thinking about.
You like Arsenal, Paolo, don't you? Would you like to see Sam there in the Steve Bold role?
I find that hard to imagine. I would say. I think it's been fun to watch. It's certainly a fun game, as Andy said, to watch Arsenal and see them playing in a slightly new mode. I think Arsenal fans might start to feel overdue to see, because Aubameyang at Dortmund missed chances as well, right? He was always
a player who missed
chances and scored chances, and that's it. You know, he's the player who gets himself in those positions, and therefore the things like what happened against Chelsea do happen. That's not a new leaf, but maybe some of the putting chances away to go alongside that would be nice, because yeah, a little bit of that would have gone a long way in this game. Bass is right, the centre backs are slow. Obviously, Lauren Koscielny is the player who would change that, but is not going to be playing until I think at least December. I think that there's some questions for Emery about how he plays with such slow centre backs. And I think it's not gone unnoticed how high of a defensive line he's using. And I think that felt very, very open to being exposed in this game, and indeed was exposed in this game at times. And I think that's something that people are going to look at and say, Mustafi and Socrates, really, can you get away with having them that far up the pitch? But in the end, the game still turns in the second half on Alexandre Lacazette just giving the ball away just ridiculously in midfield, which isn't the defence's fault.
That's... And the way he tracked was just such a so Sunday League centre forward, wasn't it? Sort of jogging around somewhere, pointing, going, oh, I was near enough.
Yeah.
And then walking away like it wasn't his fault.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing that, you know, Emery is supposed to be helping to fix, right? There was a perceived culture at Arsenal of laxness, of not sort of being, of maybe Wenger isn't willing to put the boot up anyone's backside and let them know when they're doing that sort of thing. So one would hope that that's part of Emery's remit, is to fix that sort of thing.
You also have to bear in mind, you know, it's still early days. He hasn't been there very long. And Chelsea's defence were also atrocious. You know, two really bad defensive performances, which makes for a very entertaining game.
I do wonder with Arsenal, where Emery's at. I understand it's a work in progress, but I think it does have to be an understanding that there's a whole culture to turn around. If you look at his best moments with Sevilla, and also his best moments with PSG, like when they beat Barcelona 4-0 in the Champions League before they went on to get humiliated in the second leg, that in isolation was a really good performance. And that, and also when he played with Sevilla, are far more reactive. They wouldn't have played a high line like that. And I just wonder if he has to get his head back from where he was at PSG, where his philosophy got watered down a lot by the players, who wouldn't really accept it. They wouldn't really accept being without the ball. And you know, he needs to get back to being himself. And obviously the fact that Arsenal traditionally have liked to keep the ball for the last 20 plus years, they need to move away from that. Because, you know, a lot of successful teams in the Premier League, you know, often it's a fight to win the right to counter-attack, isn't it? And if Arsenal were in that place more regularly, you know, I think they'd probably go better.
I agree with you. And I think you say, you know, whereas in contrast in this game, and look, it was a game that genuinely could have, because of the ridiculous defending and missed chances, gone either way. I think Chelsea were the better team, but it could have gone either way. Contrastingly, you would say that Sarri, well, there's lots to still fix there. He's getting his identity across already. This feels like his team already.
How key is Jorginho to that?
Oh, so key. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Jorginho's. I have been for the last couple of years watching him in Naples. I think he was the scant failure of Giampiero Ventura to understand how to use him was a big part of Italy failing to qualify for the World Cup, frankly. That and Lorenzo Insigne, obviously another savvy player. But
so how did he use him?
Until the second leg of the game against Sweden, he threw Jorginho in there, and I thought the team played better. But again, it would have helped if he'd paired him with Insigne, who, you know, they had a great understanding together. But yes, I think he's, you know, obviously the play's going to go through Jorginho. I think Kante playing in a more attacking way is leaving gaps at the back, but it's interesting to see Kante contributing in different ways. Pedro, having signed that new contract, is fitting this system very, very well, it looks like, so far. And actually, Morata looks a lot sharper, at least, and he played well at this week, the weekend, I thought, than what we've been used to recently. So I think, yeah, really positive early signs for Chelsea. I think they're a long way from the finished article under Sarri and still working things out, but it's obviously feels a lot better if you can work things out and make mistakes while picking up 6 points in your first few games.
Lovely. That'll do for part one. In part two, the rest of the Premier League, the Football League and FitBar. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We've got a live show, Barry, in Manchester.
Good.
On September the 5th. You, me, Lars and Sid. Dom says, in regards to the Mozart chat, we're at a concert hall, aren't we? So you're going to bring a Casio keyboard?
No, I'm really not. I haven't played piano since I was like 11.
I think it's
so
a great...
I literally couldn't play anything.
Well, all the more, all the better to shove a Casio keyboard in front of you. And so that's how we'll end the show. Come along. We could even do a making of. This could be where we start our DVD, you know, our sort of Amazon Prime.
Okay.
The Guardian Football Weekly making of, you know, there'll be that bit where at half time we come in and someone starts shouting, "Nobody talk!" Has anyone watched that? Have you watched the City doc, anyone?
Like Jose Mourinho, I haven't seen it, but I've formed an opinion on it anyway. thoroughly lacking in class. No, I believe it's good. I mean, I still hold Premier Passions up as the mother of them all. It was the first documentary to chronicle a behind-the-scenes season for a team. And Ken Early wrote about it in the Irish Times today. He wrote about the Manchester City one, and he said, you know, these things are always better when they're documenting failure. Mm. And the Sunderland one documented like a hideous relegation.
Yeah. I think Orient for a fiver will never be surpassed, surely.
I mean, the one where, I know it's slightly different when David Ellery was mic'd, oh, yeah. was mic'd up again, and Tony Adams had a go at him. That was.
But Jose has complained about City's lack of class. And while I thought his comments were quite funny about, you know, that he should be getting royalties, and he made fun of the fact that they had those T-shirts made up to say we won it on Derby Day and then proceeded to not win it on Derby Day, having been embarrassed by United. But, you know, Jose going on about class after all the classless things he's been involved in, you know, hanging his medical staff out to dry, causing Arsene Wenger a voyeur, calling Arsene Wenger a voyeur, insulting Rafa Benitez about his weight, yada, 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 you know, it's slightly hypocritical.
So there we are. We're live in Manchester on the 5th of September. As Dom says, in regards to the Mozart chat, G major actually has more sharps than C minor, one sharp to three flats. P.S. I'm the guy you spoke to on the phone a few months ago about performing My Humps at the live show, so I have an air of credibility. The 19th of September, we're in Oslo. Barry, Wilson and Lars. Come to that, please. Spurs 3, Fulham 1, Paolo. Another win for Spurs. They've not been totally convincing in either game, but they're winning these matches, and lots of positives for Pochettino.
Yeah, I think one of the things that was said about Tottenham coming into this season was we expect a lot of this team in general, but it had, was it nine players who reached the semi-finals of the World Cup, and therefore a bit of tiredness, a bit of sort of early season struggle was expected, perhaps, or unreadiness from players not having got back and had time to have a pre-season together. And so far, they've taken 6 points, so you can't have too much to complain about that. Yes, they let Fulham back into the game at 1-0, but they sort of finished the game comfortably enough, and with Harry Kane even scoring a goal in August. So I think it was another pretty positive afternoon all around.
Can we put Fulham in the Arsenal bracket and say they've played a lot better so far than their results would suggest? I mean, Fulham came out after half-time. They're absolutely terrific, I thought, for the first half of the second half, certainly. And, you know, they really could have got something out of that second half. Mitrovic was excellent. Quite apart from his goal, and they look the part. Jean-Michel Seri, I thought, again showed a lot of promise. I think he's going to turn into a very big player for them. I wouldn't be too worried if I was Fulham, but I think for Spurs, especially with everything that's been going on off the pitch in the last little while, very important to get it under the belt. I think very important that after looking like they were totally in control of the game, looking as if they were going to chuck it away, they then came back to win it. It's actually quite a satisfying home win in that sense.
And you mentioned those players who are like new signings, and they've got Lucas Moura, Lamella, who didn't play a lot last year, Alderweireld, who seems to be back on board. I mean,
that's your positivity, isn't it? The fact that, you know, there's no one to settle in, basically. And Lucas Moura has had that free hit 6 months. So I always felt that he was a really Tottenham player, who was certainly in the league season, arguably one of Paris's most important players in the first season of Emery. And then he was kind of left out with very little explanation. He found that quite hard to adjust to. But he's a player who did more at PSG than people give him credit for. He's a very, very good player. I thought he was good in the first game at Newcastle. And again, in this, he looks really ready, I think.
Kieran Trippier's free kick was superb, and he had another brilliant game, sort of taking his World Cup form on. And you wonder, I was very surprised that he managed to even get the ball of Christian Eriksen to take the free kick, because Eriksen might be one of the best dead ball specialists in the world.
Well, maybe Christian Eriksen saw his free kick at the World Cup. You know, I think everyone was really shocked by that, because we weren't used to seeing him take a free kick. And then when he dispatched it with such aplomb, it was, you know, wow. And to see him do it again, yeah. I don't know what kind of ego Christian Eriksen has. I suspect he's fairly laid-back character. He doesn't seem to be the kind of guy who's going to get the hump if he can't take free kicks. And as long as someone's scoring them, you know, it's a good problem to have.
Yeah, I just wondered if Eriksen, I mean, he obviously can kick it quite a lot. You know, can Trippier get more power from distance? It was a bit further out, and maybe Eriksen's better slightly closer in, or is that complete nonsense?
Are you stereotyping him because he's spindly looking?
Yeah, I am. I think Trippier's got a sort of stiffer ankle calf setup, and therefore,
would your opinion about Christian Eriksen change if he had like more manly tattoos on his forearms?
Yeah. I mean, if he went full Daniel Agger, then then I would respect him kicking the ball at distance.
Agger would actually do it for him as well, wouldn't he? Because he's actually a tattoo artist himself.
He's a tattoo artist, and he runs a sanitation business with his brother.
Is that right?
Mm.
Wow.
Which isn't called Agapoo, but clearly clearly should be. Watford a third, Paolo.
Yeah.
3-1 win at Burnley. I mean, did anyone predict this? Surely everyone predicted Burnley 1, Watford 0.
Yeah, well, I mean, Watford don't score goals away from home, right? Until suddenly they score really good ones with Andre Gray.
Oh, they were all good goals, but Gray's volley was superb, and I love that sort of driven cross from Deeney as well.
Yeah, well, it seems like Deeney and Gray actually might have something. I mean, they've had sort of very little chance to play together so far, have they? And when they have, it's looking rather promising. They're quite a nice tandem in terms of offering different things. I think the physicality of Deeney when he's on song, he can be really, really hard to play against. And yeah, you know, this is like I say, it's obviously what they're hoping to get from Gray. I don't think you can sort of expect to get a goal like that first one, but you hope for moments like that, and he's got it on him.
And actually, that assist from Doucouré, because it's just not an obvious pass to play. There's so many people running out to play that ball in, measured ball to Deeney for the second goal, was brilliant.
Yep, I agree. I mean, the only thing to say, you know, that isn't just praise for Swap for team is, you can count me in the camp that thinks that Will Hughes probably should have gone for that challenge.
Definitely.
And if he goes, then that does change the game. So I have some sympathy for Sean Dyche on that. But they were very good.
Bournemouth, 2 wins from 2, Barry.
Yeah.
They won at the Fortress London Stadium.
If I was a denizen of Fortress London Stadium, I wouldn't enjoy going there, obviously, because no one seems to. But I'd be very concerned because West Ham, their defence seems to be in absolute shambles. They need a holding midfielder desperately by the looks of things, because Josh King was given the freedom of the park and absolutely ran amok. And Bournemouth's results on the road, they aren't particularly good, but they won that game very convincingly, despite having to come from behind.
And Callum Wilson,
that goal was just wonderful. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, if Messi had scored it, we'd still be talking about it. Although we are talking about it, so well done, Callum Wilson. I thought Bournemouth's away kit looked very Bolton 2008. I was watching a Bolton. Is that Bolton? And Nick says, is there anything more frustrating when your team win a free kick and the opposition player picks up the ball and takes it with them to stop you taking the free kick? He says Bournemouth are the masters of it. Well, I hadn't noticed that with them, but I will. I mean, keep your eyes peeled for Bournemouth picking up the ball when they concede a free kick. Everton 2, Southampton 1. Barry, Mark Hughes has started complaining.
Yeah, yes, indeed. This weekend's whinge was about Jordan Pickford challenge on
Danny Ings.
Danny Ings, which left Danny Ings with his shirt torn and visible stud marks across his back, which I was wondering, will that in any way affect the tattooed area that has been scarred? I would need Daniel Agger to probably give me an expert opinion on that. But anyway,
I imagine it depends on the depth of the. If you get a stud mark, it might heal perfectly.
Yeah.
It was just a little scratch, wasn't it? Mm. And I suppose the positive for Danny Ings is normally you don't get to see a player's back tattoos, do you? But he's got a very nice, I think it's like lion on there, doesn't he? Very a mini Memphis Depay.
I don't think Pickford didn't shear his shirt enough for me to be able to make out what the tattoo was, but you know. But Mark Hughes, I thought it was Pickford was perfectly entitled to go for the ball. Mark Hughes begged to differ. He had a big moan about it after the game, and you know, even if he was right, it's just so tedious that, that, you know, it's not going to change the situation. And for just his constant moaning, you know, if you're going to moan, pick your battles. Don't do it all the time. I just find it so tiresome.
I like Barry saying, if you don't moan all the time. It just felt right about you saying that. Will, how long do you guys think it'll take before referees begin appearing on Match of the Day to complain about Mark Hughes complaining about them? It was a lovely goal from Theo Walcott, pal.
I wanted to mention that because not only was it a lovely goal, but clearly something they'd worked on the training ground as opposed to, I don't know, where else people would work on a set piece.
Pub car park.
But what really pleased me about it was that Walcott looked sort of genuinely a bit stunned and delighted that it worked. Like, his celebration, his face just looked so absolutely made up that this sort of ruse they'd had actually come together and it worked. It was just very warming.
By all accounts, Everton are playing sort of 50 yards further up the pitch than they were under Big Sam. I think there'd be lots of positivity for Everton after, you know, the point they got against Wolves,
well,
which
they
was impressive.
Just so much more inventive than they did under Big Sam, and you know, that training ground move, I would say that has to be a contender for goal of the month, but I suspect it probably won't be because those goals tend not to
no,
be.
No, we'll still be talking about Callum
Wilson's
goal. It's
so hard to pull
off
as well because there's so many things that can go wrong, you know. But yeah, they look like a team that's completely rejuvenated, and Richarlison, obviously, who's an absolute bargain at £44 million, a steal from Watford, he scored against. That's, what, 3-2 for him now, and good luck to them.
Leicester 2, Wolves 0. I mean, a wonderful own goal from Matt Doherty. Goal for James Maddison, who we have given a lot of credit to already. Lovely, lovely footballer. Vardy, red card. Thoughts on that game, Andy?
This is maybe becoming a bit of a theme this week, but Wolves were better than the result looks. Much better than the result looks. And I think could have got at least a point out of it. They started the game really spectacularly well. And, of course, that freakish own goal really knocked them back. I tend to think they'll still do pretty well. I think it's not unreasonable for them to aim higher this season. I've been really impressed by João Moutinho. A lot of people have wondered if he would have the legs for the Premier League. I thought he was really, really good, although, you know, they could do with maybe more of an athlete in the centre of the park with him and Ruben Neves. Obviously, goal scoring is now the question for them. I've noticed that people have started wondering already, could Raul Jimenez, who I think has started the season quite well, score the goals to get them where they want to go? There's such a small sample size with him. That's the problem, because he didn't start many games for Benfica and started even fewer games for Atletico Madrid before that, really. So I think if you look at him goals per minute, it's actually a pretty good return. So, you know, there's no reason to think that he shouldn't be able to score goals for Wolves. You just wonder, like, you know, is it going to be a case of the midfield pitching in?
If they need an athlete, Usain Bolt has landed in Australia to start his A-League career with the Central Coast Mariners. So, you know, Nuno can keep an eye on him, see how he does. Although, you've got to play him up top, haven't you? Really. It's going to change the way you play if you've got Bolt in your side, isn't it? Cardiff 0, Newcastle 0. How much fun did you enjoy Kennedy's entire performance in this football match, Barry?
It was extraordinary. Because he's been really impressive for Newcastle since he went there and gave them an immediate lift when he went on loan last season. But this was just one of those, you know, when you just have a really, really bad day. Everything goes wrong.
He didn't find a teammate in the whole of the first half.
Didn't find a teammate in the whole of the first half. He should have been sent off yes. in the first half, but wasn't. And on the evidence of what was to follow, his teammates probably wish he had been, because they could only have improved in his absence. And then in the second half, he was again dismal, and Newcastle got a free kick just before the 90-minute mark, and for some bizarre reason, he was allowed to take it.
The penalty?
Sorry, no, a free kick.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Free kick in an excellent position. I would have thought maybe he was one for John Joe Shelby or somebody, but Kennedy took it. It was a feeble effort straight into the wall. They get the penalty 4 minutes into added time. His effort is feeble, and Neil Etheridge saves it, his second penalty save in as many games. And it was, you know, Newcastle did not deserve to win the game, so justice, you could say, was served. But it was an extraordinarily bad performance. I can't think of many that stand out in my mind. I think I remember Johnny Evans had an absolute mare for Manchester United once. I think it might have been against West Ham or somebody, and I thought, he'll never play for them again. It was so bad.
Somebody got two own goals in a game once. I mean, that is I can't remember who it was, but that's disappointing. But yeah, he was so, I mean, he just couldn't even kick it, could he? I mean, you were just, when he was over the penalty, you were like, that is really strange. No,
is he drunk?
Yeah. Someone else, surely there's someone else. Anyway, tonight Palace play Liverpool. Liverpool's goalkeeping coach, Paolo, has been preparing Alisson for the physical contest with rugby tackle bags. I don't know what this says about what Liverpool's goalkeeping coach thinks of Christian Benteke as a footballer. But I think, I mean, apart from Palace, and Palace have a good record against Liverpool, I think we're just so desperate for a title race that I quite want Liverpool to win this game.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose if the teams we've already mentioned, I don't think Tottenham could be excluded from a title race if they play what they're capable of. But yeah, it's a very Jurgen Klopp sort of training strategy, it feels like, doesn't it? It's all that sort of feels like his methodology to do something that's a little bit outside the box. And I think that's part of why Liverpool are, you know, and indeed before them, Dortmund stay in these sort of good headspaces. I think making training fun, making it a little bit different, is part of Klopp's thing. It's part of what...
Never used a rugby tackle.
It was Jonathan Walters, by the way, producer Sammy says, who scored two own goals in one game. The Football League... West Brom QPR 1-1 at half time, 7-1 to West Brom at full time. Steve McLaren, the QPR boss, says, "I'm shocked. I couldn't believe the collapse. It's unacceptable. We can't have that. It's unacceptable for the fans. It's unacceptable for the club. Now we have to react on Tuesday." West Brom's, I mean, I haven't seen any footage of the boiler mascot dancing around. I don't want to reduce West Brom to just being a team with a mascot that's a combi boiler.
They brought it upon themselves.
They absolutely did, didn't they? But that is a devastating result for QPR, isn't it, Barry?
Yeah, it is. QPR are in all sorts of difficulty. They have this ongoing transfer embargo. I think they had to pay a £47 million fine for transfer shenanigans. And Steve McLaren did look genuinely shocked after the result, but it's his team. He has to try and do something to fix it in the game and after the game, and raising morale after a crushing defeat like that. You know, Huddersfield suffered similarly, but they were playing Manchester City. West Brom are a decent side in the Championship, but they ain't no Manchester City, are they? And to ship 7 goals, 6 in 45 minutes, that's very worrying.
Whatever he said at half-time, it really didn't work, did it? Bielsa's Leeds, the only team with 100% record in the Championship after a 2-0 win over Rotherham. They're 1 point behind Middlesbrough, who played a game more. They won at Bristol City. Have you seen this footage of the Preston-Stoke game?
Yes.
Police using pepper spray at Stoke fans at half-time in the away concourse. I mean, Andy, those videos, they just never look good, do they?
That seems really heavy-handed. I mean, you know, we're not talking about... I mean, I've only seen the clip, but we're not talking about there being an actual fight. It just seemed like the police waded in there. It's very, very unusual.
Reading some of the local news reports from both sort of papers, Sentinel and whatever the other one is, it seems that if they are correct, the Stoke fans... Some, I believe, or it has been reported, were fighting amongst themselves. There were quite a few wanting to go out and smoke, and a lot of them were, you know, it was near an area where there were toilets, so there were kids there going to the toilet at half time, and yeah, it just seemed an extraordinarily heavy-handed approach by the police.
Paul Elliott from the football officer from Preston North End said, look, I'm a PC. I've been working in football operations for 12 years. Every game home and away, I take everything that happens at Preston games personally. I can assure all Stoke fans the incident that occurred at halftime today will be fully investigated. There'll be a full post-match debrief on Tuesday. All commanders involved will attend. I would request any Stoke fans with observations or footage to email me about them, and I'll personally inform Stoke fans and fan groups of the outcome. We'll invite a representative from the FSF to attend for total transparency. I sincerely apologise to any innocent Stoke fans caught up in this incident. In League One, this is from Tom. I'm fed up with the anti-Peterborough United bias peddled by the Scumbridge supporting Max Rushton. When will you give credit where it's due to the runaway leaders of League One? Well, Portsmouth have got exactly the same number of points as you, I'd like to point out, so you're not running away with it. Portsmouth are in second.
But they're running away hand in hand with Portsmouth.
I am devastated to report that Peterborough are top of League One. 3 wins out of 3. They beat Luton, so at least that's some saving grace. Portsmouth are second. Did you see the story from Sunderland, Barry? Who have started very well. The extent of your financial mismanagement has been laid bare. Your director, Charlie Methven, revealed the former regime was spending a staggering £1,000 a month on rearranging plastic plants in the office.
The thing that got me with that was not the sum of money involved, but the fact that the plants were plastic. That's just scream Sunderland football. They're sort of stupid enough to waste huge amounts of money on rearranging plants, but too tight to actually spring for proper plants.
What understood from it was they had a section of plastic plants, but to freshen it up, they moved them around from different room to different room. Is that right?
I don't know.
I don't know why that would cost you so much.
Why would that be so expensive?
Sunderland have a way. Anyway, League Two. Every team has dropped points here. 4 teams are on 7 points. Exeter, Lincoln, Stevenage and MK Dons. Exeter go to the mighty Cambridge, who staged 2 miraculous fight backs away at Northampton at the weekend to get a 2-2 draw. Fitbar Barry, Kenny Miller, who I saw a VT, Kenny, just at the weekend, say how much he was enjoying being a player manager, how it was difficult to tackle both things, but how he was surprised he wasn't at Rangers, but it was a great new opportunity for him, and he was very much enjoying playing, affecting the game, and he could also manage as well, and he's gone.
Yeah, he's at Livingston. He replaced David Hopkin over the summer. Hopkin had guided Livingston back to the Scottish Premiership with back-to-back promotions, but couldn't agree a new contract, so left the club. I think he had ambitions of going somewhere else. I checked. He hasn't gone anywhere else at the moment. But yeah, Kenny Miller took over as player manager. Livingston have played 7 games under him. He's played in them all, scored 1 goal. The results are quite good. I mean, 5 of those games are Scottish League Cup games, and they got knocked out yesterday, but before that they were unbeaten in the group stage. It's a weird format they have this year. And he was on 2 months probation, and the 2 months end at the end of August, but he and the club announced yesterday that they had amicably decided to part company. But Kenny Miller is understood to be unhappy with some of this behind the scenes admin stuff, so I presume Kenny Miller's a pretty outspoken guy. I'd imagine we'll find out soon enough what happened. But
Stevie G could come in for him and get him back,
possibly. There's talk he'll go to St Mirren. Okay. So it was a pretty I'm not sure why, but this weekend, the Scottish football was devoted to the Scottish League Cup. So we have the quarterfinalists now, and it's Aberdeen, Hearts, St Johnstone, Ayr, Rangers, Hibs, Hearts, Celtic, all through to the last 8 of that tournament. I asked a Celtic supporting pal of mine yesterday why this was, you know, to interrupt the league season so quickly, just after 2 games, and he had no idea.
It's too early for quarterfinals, frankly. It's ridiculous. Right, that'll do for part 2. In part 3, we'll talk Europe. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain. Sid Lowe is there. Sid, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Thank you very much. This is a question from David. It says, is it more disrespectful to fans to play a league game in North America or to play a league game at 10:15 p.m. local time and have it finished the next day?
Well, in a way, both things kind of go hand in hand in that they both tell you something about the importance with which fans are treated, in other words, the complete lack of it. I suppose in a way that the 10:15 at night thing is always justified as being, this is the summer, all of the timetables are later, people are on holiday anyway, they're not going to work the next day, none of which is entirely true, although it is certainly true that the high temperatures mean that playing games late is kind of important. But yeah, to the extent of 10:15, no.
How does this North American news played out over there?
Well, I mean, I mean, you know, this kind of probably reflects my own particular opinion on this. But I'm struck, just as I was with when Spain played the Super Cup in Morocco, what was it, a week ago now, I'm struck by the fact that a country like Spain, whose media basically lives off debate and arguments and shouting matches and angriness and creating huge controversies and polemics about absolutely nothing, has finally got a subject that genuinely worth debating about, genuinely matters up to a point. I mean, I realise obviously it's only one game a year, and it's not really been debated that much. It became a piece of news, and it's like, oh, well, there we go then. And I think that tells you something about the... I personally think, anyway, and again, this is my personal opinion, that it tells you something about the overly cosy nature of the relationship between parts of the media and the league. I think it tells you something about the fact that, in a way, the whole thing, the whole debate and argument and stuff is show. And so when it comes to something important, actually, there isn't really a desire necessarily to talk about it properly. But it's kind of, oh, well, this is going to happen, and on it goes. Of course, one of the reasons for that is we don't yet know which game it's going to be. And I think at that point, obviously, when we get a better sense of how this will play out in practice, not just in principle, then I think we may see a kind of, if you like, another round of responses.
Have they given any idea of a timescale of when they're going to make those sort of decisions? Start of each season, when?
No, I mean, they've said that they want to do one this year, but they do want to do one this season. Charlie Filicano, who's, of course, the person behind all of this, was listening to an interview with him the other day, and I suppose the one comforting thing in it was that he did talk about trying to find a way of accommodating Spanish fans and finding a way of making the damage to them, or the impact of this as little as possible. But then he fundamentally failed to answer the actual direct questions he was asked. But he has said that the idea, at least to start with, is that he wants this game to involve basically Madrid or Barcelona. Almost certainly what would happen is that it would be Madrid or Barcelona, one of their away games against a smaller team. Now, obviously, that opens up all sorts of questions about the integrity of the league, about the whole nature of the fact that the league is supposedly kind of what makes it a league, is that everyone plays everyone home and away twice. The other thing is that there was a story a couple of days ago suggesting that this might well be Barcelona's away game at Betis, which would be played in Miami. Obviously, given the timing of that, because I think it's around a Champions League round of games, I don't think that's very plausible, although, as I say, there's no reason to necessarily to doubt that this story has something in it. And if it was Betis, then I think we will see a response, because if you take a game away from Betis, which is a club with over 50,000 season ticket holders, and you say, you know what, that big game that you've got against Barcelona, the one that you really look forward to, the one that you're playing at home, we're going to take it to Miami and put it there, where, by the way, everyone will be supporting Barcelona. And of course, that at heart is kind of part of the crux of why this is so problematic, because, you know, this isn't a one-off game. This is part of a league process. And if you debilitate teams that are already at a disadvantage, you know, that kind of part of both the practical and, I suppose, also principled reason why it doesn't entirely work.
How was week one of the league itself?
Well, I enjoyed it. I was at Betis's game on Friday night, expecting them to play really well because they've had a very good preseason. They were excellent last year, and they got beaten by Levante with Morales scoring, well, one of the goals was absolutely fantastic. I mean, he's a brilliant player, and if you give him space, he'll destroy you, which he did. I think I saw one of the newspaper headlines that said Morales is Maradona. Which I don't know if that's quite the compliment it once was. Anyway, Morales is Maradona. And then yesterday I was in Eibar, which is one of the prettiest little stadiums in Spain, to see the first ever first division game for Huesca, who came up and have had a whole history of playing in the third and the second division B, not even that many years in the second division, their first division game.
And the goal was scored by Alex Gallar, and it's an absolutely brilliant goal as well. And then after the game, he was saying, yeah, but you know, after you've seen Messi and Morales, it goes behind them, doesn't it? It's not as good as their goals. I'm thinking, well, hang on, this is the first goal your team has ever scored in the First Division. So I think his is the best of the weekend.
Probably the biggest game of the weekend is happening at the end of the weekend,
yeah.
Between Valencia and Atletico. I mean, it's funny, isn't it, for Atletico, because a lot of people all over Europe are saying, or maybe with Real Madrid having at least mini transitional period, and Barcelona still looking not that excited, maybe this is the season for Atletico, as they've won the transfer window. It's a different pressure for them to deal with, isn't it? And Diego Simeone's got to show that he's tactically moved on if they're going to show the wit to win the biggest matches and to get themselves in a position to win the league.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in a way, I'd part of the question might well be not so much having the ability to win the biggest matches, although it is true, of course, that Barcelona beat them last season, but as the ability maybe to win those games that perhaps they would sometimes draw against the slightly less big teams. And it's curious about Atletico. I mean, first of all, it's kind of curious that, you know, the biggest game, the opening round of the weekend is on a Monday night, which always feels a little bit kind of shunted to the side, although I think this is big enough that it will overcome that. But one of the things that's happened with Atletico Madrid pretty much every year, I think, for the last 3 years, is that in each season they've made signings that have looked to be the, if you like, the prelude to something a little bit more creative. And they've kind of evolved into a slightly more creative team. And then there's been a stage of the season, normally quite early, it's been at slightly different points in each of the last two or three seasons, in which they kind of evolve back again. I think, actually, you know what? We know the things that we do really well, and we're going to stick to them. And that doubt is always, I suppose, whether they'll win sufficient numbers of games to win the league. And to give you an example of this, when they won the title, is it 4 years ago now, 5 years ago, an Atletico Madrid player said to me in, I think it was October, November, look, we can't win a 100-point league, because there was an awareness that they weren't going to get beaten very much, but there would be points dropped with draws at places, you know, that maybe they'd go away to Leganes, as I think they did, and draw 0-0, and then it just kind of, you know, there'd be moments when they drop points without ever doing anything seriously wrong, but maybe not having the creativity to come through those kind of games. He said, but we can win the Champions League because we're good enough, and obviously head-to-head it's different. As it turned out, they did win the league, and they finished in, you know, 30 seconds away from winning the Champions League as well. Of course, what happened was that season, it wasn't a 100-point league. It came down, I think, to 88 or maybe 90 points. This season, the question, I suppose, is whether they can push that points total up sufficiently themselves, or whether Madrid and Barcelona, as you say, will come back down again. But I think it is true that the pressure is very different this year, and people are actually talking about them because the investment's been huge. There's a sense that, actually, you know what, now there is a bit of obligation. This wouldn't be a miracle like it was then. And I think to come to the very basic point, in a way, I think their chances, you know, on the opening weekend of the season, when you look at what's coming up, their chances of winning the league this year are probably stronger than they were the year they actually won it.
On paper, Barcelona 3, Alaves 0, and Real Madrid 2, Getafe 0 look quite straightforward. Is that how it was?
Yeah, relatively. I mean, Barcelona was just Leo Messi being Leo Messi, I suppose, and he was absolutely extraordinary. One of the things about Messi, I suppose, is that he makes a ridiculous slow routine that in the end you kind of almost don't notice. But people did this time, I suppose, because you've come off the back of the World Cup when it didn't work out for him, and people haven't seen him for a bit, so he comes back and plays amazing. And oh yeah, that guy's quite good, isn't he? And then obviously the context is different with Ronaldo having gone now. The Madrid game was. I think a comfortable and reasonably good Madrid performance. It may be lacking that. Well, one of the words that was used in Spain to refer to this was maybe lacking that sort of touch of electricity, you know, touch of excitement. But it was a reasonably good performance. I think we've seen a much more collective identity to the Madrid team. At least that's what's starting to be formed now. And of course, a goal for Gareth Bale, and that's going to be really important. I get the feeling this is going to be a huge season for them.
Sid, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
Have a lovely day. Sid Lowe, out in Spain. Italy, Paolo. Serie A began. You know about Italian football.
Yes.
And Ronaldo began in Chievo. Did he have a nice time?
He had a moderately nice time, I guess. He won, which I suppose it always encourages a nice time. His tweet afterwards suggested that he was happy that he had won. But he didn't score. And of course, this is going to be the saga that we have to go
Ronaldo's
through.
Baron run
exactly.
Continues.
Every weekend now in Serie A, no doubt, it's going to be a big constant sort of running thing of has Ronaldo scored this week? And unless, of course, he starts hammering them in at such a rate that it becomes relevant. He did look a bit like, I don't know, an object that didn't quite fit in that team this weekend. And that's not such a shock. It's the beginning of a new team and a new season. He hasn't had that much time actually working with his teammates. If you think he came back from the World Cup while everyone else was still away playing in the International Champions Cup, the number of days they've really had to train together isn't that many. But he did, you know, he did look isolated. His sort of understanding with Paulo Dybala wasn't quite there. You wonder if there's sort of still some evolution to come in terms of formation. They sort of lined up in a 4-2-3-1 this time around, but actually Ronaldo got more into the game almost. Interestingly, when late in the game, Mario Mandzukic came on, he was pushed out to the left wing, which of course is the home that is no longer his home, but he looked a bit more comfortable there. He certainly was linking up with Alexandro well once he was sort of pushed a little bit further left. But I suppose, which I haven't mentioned yet, of course, is what actually happened, which is that Juventus scored after 3 minutes against Kiev. I went 1-0 up, and everyone's sort of expecting this sort of easy ride, very attacking lineup with Ronaldo and Dybala and Cuadrado and Douglas Costa and Pjanic all in the lineup, and Alexandro and Cancelo on the fullbacks as well. So the team sort of really geared up to attack and looked like Juventus might blow Kiev away, but then instead what happened is the sort of script got flipped either side of half time with Chievo first equalising, and then Giaccherini, who of course is an ex-Juventus player, winning and then converting a penalty in the second half. And Juventus had to really sort of dig in and get that victory, get level with their own goal, and then get a 92nd minute winner from Federico Bernardeschi. So in some ways, you would say it was a very Juventus introduction for Ronaldo, because this has been Juventus over the last few years under Allegri. They haven't always sparkled in domestically, especially early in seasons when Allegri is sort of quite commonly taken time to try different tactics and fiddle with the system, because there's always been turnover every summer. There's been big players coming in and out. But they find ways to win. They find ways to pick up the 3 points, and that's exactly what they did.
Interesting is probably not the right word. Bizarre story from Lazio, their ultras. Have you seen this? Causing outrage, telling women to avoid their sacred space in a message written on flyers and distributed ahead of their game against Napoli. Said the Curva Nord represents for us a sacred space and environment with an unwritten code to be respected. The first few rows have always have been experienced like the trenches. In the trenches, we do not allow women, wives and girlfriends. We invite them to position themselves from the 10th row back. It's just bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, the message fundamentally is abhorrent. I think we have to be a little careful always with things like this, because what's happened is, as you say, there's a flyer, which is essentially an A4 printed sheet of paper, has been found spread across the front 10 rows of the Curva, saying, yes, basically women can be here, but they can't be in the front 10 rows of the Curva. And it's signed off on this letter, Diabolic Pluto. Now, there is a known Lazio Ultra called... who goes by the moniker Diabolique, who is sort of one of the capi of the Irriducibili, which is one of the big ultra groups at Lazio. So there's sort of the presumption that what appears to be written on this paper is okay, this is giving the indication that it's come from him, this message. Now, he hasn't presented an official comment on it. It's absurd that we talk about ultras and official comments, but this is the world as it is. Often messages that are sort of directives, as it were, from the heads of the ultras are typically signed off Irriducibili. So some people are saying, well, who is this actually from? Is it spread by someone? Someone has seen fit to put it out there. It's a grim message. And look, even the ultras, we can talk about the Irriducibili. They are one group of ultras, and they are a very powerful group of ultras within the Lazio support, but they're not the only ones. These aren't sort of homogenous groups, and no doubt there is disagreement even within those groups about whether this message is correct, whether it's appropriate and all the rest of it, whether it's there because it's actually sort of handed down from Diabolik or it's a troublemaker. In any case, it's unpleasant, and it's not a welcome message, and Lazio have been quick to distance themselves from it, and you know, rightly so. But, you know, to an extent, we're entering into the game that whoever put this wants us to do by giving it the publicity, by saying, you know, let's all talk about this. You know, it's whoever decided to put that down there, that's exactly what they want, is so that we can all effectively promote their handiwork.
If I can move away from and not give them the publicity. Our old friend Jimbo would have been excited to see Parma back in the Serie A. How did they get on?
Yeah, they did. They started off with a draw So yeah, 2-2 with Udinese.
A brace for Asprilla.
Yeah.
Thomas Brolin with the 2 assists. I recall last season there seemed to be a problem, that just a huge gulf in class, that some of the teams in Serie A just weren't good enough and well equipped enough to stay there. And is that going to be the case again this season? I, you know, I'm talking to like the Beneventos and.
Yeah,
this world.
There's a huge gulf in terms of the haves and have-nots financially in Italy, and you know, this weekend's probably an apt moment to talk about it, because actually Chievo unquestionably would be one of the have-nots. They're not a team that's supposed to be able to compete, especially now when you look at what Juventus are trying to do. Juventus, who are sort of trying to move up to be one of the top teams in the world in terms of revenue. What they can do at the moment, what Inter can do. It's interesting that Inter immediately, even sort of having got back into the Champions League, their commercial revenue is already sort of trending towards being one of the few teams that could almost keep up with Juventus, because actually even a club like Roma has a gap to Juventus, even a club like Napoli has a gap to Juventus. But there's a very distinct financial gap between the top 5 or 6 clubs in the division and the rest of the league. And yes, teams like Parma, teams like, even much more so, teams like Frosinone are going to be... playing catch up, but there's a group of those teams. It's not just that there's three. There's, you know, there's 5 or 6 of those teams who are likely to be fighting for survival. And just, yeah, I suppose to illustrate the point you're talking about, Baz, I mean, we're talking about. But I suppose until recently with the TV deals, is this different in the Premier League? We're talking about, you know, wage bills that are 10 times the size. You know, we're talking about teams with wage bills that are not even Cristiano Ronaldo's wages. The gap is vast. But whether or not that's so different to every other top league in Europe, I'm actually not sure.
I think it's become a thing in Italy over the last years, hasn't it, with smaller names getting promoted. It was something that Claudio Lotito, the Lazio president, talked about, like, quite and he was quite unpopular for doing, yeah, so in recent years. But you know, you do look at it and you think, well, is there a point where maybe Serie A can't sustain 20 clubs?
Well, I think the idea that Serie A would be better off at 18 clubs is actually very popular with fans. I think that's actually got a lot of support. What it doesn't have is sort of political support, because those clubs who have their brief moments in the top flight, you know, need it financially. And the fact is that the lower divisions in Italy, there's a lot of teams struggling hugely. I mean, you see a team like Bari, who traditionally big club, who have potential to have quite a lot of support, going bust again. This happens over and over because there's no money in the game, and it's not like in England where there's so much coming into the top division that even if parachute payments are often decried as sort of insufficient, or the amount that is spread down to football leagues often decried as insufficient, it's still vastly more than what the lower league clubs can rely on in Italy. So you are much more then reliant on your base of what you can bring in as a club, and then, you know, extend that beyond TV deals. Your average Italian has far less money in his pocket than your average English person does, and therefore has less money to spend on going to the stadium. So if you can't get your money from your TV deals, and you can't get your money from selling tickets at a stadium which is run down and which fans don't necessarily want to go to anyway, where's your money coming from? And that sort of problem plagues all the way down. And yes, I suppose it creates a bigger gap between those who have the structural capacity that even if they aren't doing so well, they can bring in fans and fill seats. But then, as I said, even a club like Bari, who actually do still have good support, if they're not run well, can continue to founder for a very long time.
Paolo, what about Carlo Ancelotti? I mean, Napoli had a really dreadful pre-season. A lot of people have looked at his last couple of jobs and said, well, maybe he doesn't create the intensity necessary for modern teams. They started really badly at Lazio on Saturday night, which was a big game for them already, even though it was the first one of the season, and yet they came back and won the game.
Yes, I was, you know, really pleased for Carlo. He's, you know, unfortunately, I obviously need to separate myself journalistically and impartially, but he's just one of those people who's very hard not to feel good for and want good things for. And I think he stepped into a really tough job at Napoli, because more than any other sort of club in Italy, perhaps in the top flight, and certainly more than Juventus, they're a club with a very clear, specific tactical identity under Maurizio Sarri, and to inherit that and take it over whilst losing Jorginho, who was at the very sort of heart of it, is a big ask. But Napoli won away to Lazio, which is an extremely impressive first weekend result. Lazio finished 5th last season by a whisker, They did it having gone a goal down. They did it playing a football that was not wholly dissimilar to what they played under Sarri, frankly, but with perhaps it seemed like a little bit more balance in terms of the two wings. His side was sort of notably getting forward more. And the other big difference was you had Arkadiusz Milik, who's sort of been, I guess, for a couple of years now, there in the background and overshadowed by Dries Mertens' sort of explosion as a false nine, never really getting to be the number nine. This was a sort of proper number nine, and he was very, very good. So the hope will be that Ancelotti can take a lot of what Sarri did well and build on it. It's what he said he's trying to do. He's not trying to tear it up. But of course, you know, one game in and only early days. But yeah, I was impressed.
In Ligue 1, Kylian Mbappe got two goals on his return to action as PSG came from behind to win 3-1 at Guingamp, or Guingamp, or however you want to say it.
Guingamp.
Along with PSG and Reims, who beat Lyon 1-0 on Friday night. The other team in the division currently with 6 points are Dijon after they defeated Nantes 2-0 at home. Bad news for Lee Catamol, Barry.
Yes, sorry, I was slumped back in my chair.
No, that's okay.
Gospoy has been sacked.
He's been suspended by Bordeaux.
And he's going to get fired later in the week.
He hit out after their 2-1 win over Mariupol in the Europa League after he'd been told his centre-forward Gaëtan Laborde had been sold to Montpellier without his knowledge. I am not happy. It's one of my worst days at the club. What the club have done with Gaëtan is a disgrace. I think we have to stop here. I told the club not to leave him until we bought someone else. They've not recruited and they let him go. I arrived at 11:35 a.m. Laborde was not here. He was in Montpellier. Nobody told me anything. So no Lee Catamol at Bordeaux. Well, unless the new manager coming in decides to sign Catamol.
Well, the new manager might be Thierry Henry. So I'd love to see that as a fit.
He's a sort of Thierry Henry type of player, I would say.
I think so.
Yeah. David Moyes is the front runner to take the USA job, apparently.
Yeah, that's been vacant for a very long time because they've had an interim manager in since they failed to qualify for the World Cup.
And finally, good news for Manchester United women's team because they won their first ever competitive game in the FA Continental Tyres Cup 1-0 against Liverpool. So some positive news for Manchester United fans amidst the pain of what Jose's doing. Finally, one question from Oliver. Would it be dumb following the discussion around innovating the Carabao Cup to suggest whether it could become a five-a-side tournament?
I'd watch it.
I really like that idea, but can it happen after Wimbledon play West Ham next week, please?
Oh, yeah, absolutely right.
Right, great.
Yeah, have you got them home or away?
At home.
Oh, I think you might be incredible. The favourites for that one.
It's incredible. Like, next week, Wimbledon have Sunderland on Saturday in the league and then West Ham in the Cup on Tuesday. It's incredible. I mean, supporting AFC Wimbledon is a series of moments where you go, I can't believe we're playing this team in the league. You know, like 7-8 years ago, that was York. Then it was Luton.
Got to MK
Dons.
Then
it was Portsmouth. Yeah. And yeah, now it's Sunderland.
Well, good for you. Not as good as getting a 2-2 draw, scrapping a 2-2 draw at Northampton. But it was nice to play you while you're in the same division as us. We wish you well in League One. Thanks for your time, Barry Glendenning.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Paolo.
Cheers.
Thanks, Andy.
Thanks a lot.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.